Please turn to Deuteronomy chapter 32. In chapter 31, God prepares the people of Israel for the departure of their great, great leader Moses. Some of you who were here a couple of weeks ago when we preached on Deuteronomy 31 will recall that the text was very relevant for the church of our age, even for our church, a church that always needs to look for new leaders. The old ones are here, but they won't be here forever. The church needs to be renewed continually. And what a challenge it was for Israel as they were on the brink of the promised land. And they were not about to lose a leader. They were about to go across Jordan without the great, great Moses. Can you imagine going anywhere without Jesus? Can you imagine going anywhere without your Lord? Going across Jordan without Moses comes mighty close to it. From the vantage point of these people, it was a great challenge. And here now is a second installment of this preparation for the people for life without Moses. It's a song, it's a shira, a song that is a catechetical song. And you may not realize how many things we still learn by way of singing. Children learn by way of singing. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, all good things will go to heaven. Things like this. And don't quote me on this. All right, here is Deuteronomy chapter 32. Then Moses spoke the words of this song until they were finished in the ears of all the assembly of Israel. Give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain upon the tender grass, and like showers on the herb. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God. The rock, his work is perfect, for all his ways are justice. A God of faithfulness and without iniquity, just and upright is he. They have dealt corruptly with him. They are no longer his children, because they are blemished, and they are a crooked and twisted generation. Do you thus repay the Lord, you foolish and senseless people? Is not he your father who created you, who made you and established you? Now remember the days of old. Consider the years of many generations. Ask your father and he will show you, your elders and they will tell you. When the Most High gave to the nations their inheritance, when he divided mankind, he fixed the borders of the peoples according to the number of the sons of God. But the Lord's portion is his people, Jacob, his allotted heritage. So he found him in a desert and in the howling waste of the wilderness. He encircled him, he cared for him, he kept him as the apple of his eye. Like an eagle that stirs up its nest, that flutters over its young, spreading out its wings, catching them, bearing them on its pinions, the Lord alone guided him. No foreign god was with him. He made him ride on the high places of the land, and he ate the produce of the field, and he suckled him with honey out of the rock and oil out of the flinty rock, curds from the herd and milk from the flock with fat of lambs, rams of Bashan, and goats with the very finest of the wheat, and you drank foaming wine made from the blood of the grape. But Jeshurun grew fat and kicked. You grew fat, stout, and sleek. And then he forsook God who made him and scoffed at the rock of his salvation. They stirred him to jealousy with strange gods, with abominations they provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons that were no gods, to gods they had never known, to new gods that had come recently, whom your fathers had never dreaded. You were unmindful of the rock that bore you, and you forgot the God who gave you birth. The Lord saw it and spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. And he said, I will hide my face from them. I will see what their end will be, for they are a perverse generation, children, in whom is no faithfulness. They have made me jealous with what is no God. They have provoked me to anger with their idols. So I will make them jealous with those who are no people. I will provoke them to anger with a foolish nation. For a fire is kindled by my anger, and it burns to the depths of Sheol, devours the earth and its increase, and sets on fire the foundations of the mountains. And I will heap disasters upon them. I will spend my arrows on them. They shall be wasted with hunger and devoured by plague and poisonous pestilence. I will send the teeth of beasts among them with the venom of things that crawl in the dust. Outdoors the sword shall bereave, and indoors terror for young man and woman alike, the nursing child with a man of gray hairs. I would have said, I will cut them to pieces. I will wipe them from human history, had I not feared provocation by the enemy. Lest their adversaries should misunderstand, lest they should say, our hand is triumphant. It was not the Lord who did all this. For they are a nation void of counsel, and there is no understanding in them. If they were wise, they would understand this. They would discern their latter end. For how could one have chased 1,000 and two have put 10,000 to flight, unless their rock had sold them and the Lord had given them up? For the rock, their rock, is not as our rock. Our enemies are by themselves. For their vine comes from the vine of Sodom and from the fields of Gomorrah. Their grapes are grapes of poison. Their clusters are bitter. Their wine is the poison of serpents and the cruel venom of asps. Is not this laid up in store with me, sealed up in my treasuries? Vengeance is mine, and recompense. For the time when their foot shall slip, for the day of their calamity is at hand, and their doom comes swiftly. For the Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants, when he sees that their power is gone and there is none remaining, bond or free. Then he will say, where are their gods, the rock in which they took refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices and drank the wine of their drink offerings? Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your protection. And see now that I, even I, am he, and there is no God beside me. I kill and I make alive. I wound and I heal, and there is none that can deliver out of my hand. For I lift up my hand to heaven and swear, as I live forever, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold of judgment, I will take vengeance on my adversary and will repay those who hate me. I will make my arrows drunk with blood, and my sword shall devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired heads of the enemy. Rejoice with him, O heavens! Bow down to him, all gods! For he avenges the blood of his children. He takes vengeance on his adversaries. He repays those who hate him and cleanses his people's land. Moses came and recited all the words of this song in the hearing of the people, he and Joshua the son of Nun. And when Moses had finished speaking all these words to all Israel, he said to them, take to heart all the words by which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. For it is no empty word for you, but your very life. And by this word you shall live long in the land that you are going over the Jordan to possess. So, part two of this postscript of Moses who is about to say farewell is the Shirah, the song of Moses. It's a song to be sung and to be remembered for all generations in Israel. It's a catechetical song, a song that children will be taught to remember, to be able to recite from heart, and then to sing before their parents, to sing before the village in unison. A catechetical song that functions as a witness to past, present, and future of the entire nation. It tells a story of God's faithfulness and Israel's unfaithfulness. A panoramic summary of how Israel would receive the blessing of life in God's promised land. How they would enjoy the goodness of the Lord in Canaan. How they would grow fat. How they would grow complacent. And on account of which, how they would forsake and forget the Lord. How they would worship foreign gods, and how God would turn out to be their enemy on account of their sin, and as verse 23 says, spend his arrows on them. Indeed, the entire first part of the poem, all the way through verse 29, delineates the contrast, a sharp contrast between faithful God and faithless people, ending in judgment and exile. The litany of Israel's moral bankruptcy, moral and spiritual bankruptcy, is so complete, so pervasive, that they're almost beyond help. That is to say, they are beyond help. They are beyond help. But then comes a surprising turning point in verse 30, which opens the second part of the song. It's at this, the darkest point of the song, that a future redemption emerges. Yahweh will deal with Israel's enemies. He will smite them, strike them, cut them down, and he will restore his people. Verse 43 then issues a final cry of triumph and a call to worship God, to all gods, all who are great, all who are small. And so initially, the song closes down hope. Israel is a nation without future, capable only of disobedience, so it would seem, locked in folly by nature. Always doing the same thing, always hoping for a new result, but of course it cannot come. They are perverse, that's what God says. They're perverse and they are twisted. And yet now, as the song's second half begins, a note of optimism prevails, and it comes out of nowhere. God will not abandon his people to disobedience. He will do it for one and one reason only. He doesn't want anyone to say, oh, this is just a part of human history. Nation so-and-so took care of them, took them out of the equation. He will do it for his own name's sake, so that all the work that he has done from beginning to end will not seem as though the work of men's hands, but of God's. He will do it for his own name's sake. And so he will not abandon his people to disobedience. There is hope for Israel in even God's punitive intervention. There is hope for Israel in even God's judgment. And it's striking that the last words of Moses, or let's put it this way, that among the last words of Moses, there's a song. Moses, the great lawgiver. Moses, the man, the mediator of the covenant. Moses and the law go hand in hand. It's striking that among the last words of this man, the lawgiver, is a song. Poetry is so unusual for this book of Deuteronomy. Entailed in this choice, and it's a choice that has been made, entailed in this choice is also the realization that the law by itself isn't the way of salvation for anyone. The ultimate function of the law is not to enable obedience, but to expose disobedience and failure, paving the way for the divine intervention that will become necessary, which will eventually result in a new lease on life and a new intimacy with God Himself. This is the theme of Moses' song. This is the story that it tells. As I said, law by itself cannot do this. Law never tells a story, not by itself. Law cannot preach hope. Law can only deliver, lay down law. Poetry, however, is apt to tell the story. A mystery of divine purposes on the long and winding road of the people's countless sins. You really do need the help of God to see God's purposes in all of it. And ultimately, and this is true for all of us, it's true for you, ultimately there is hope only in God's intervention. The law can't be kept. The word can't be done, not even by the great Moses. He won't cross over the Jordan, and you know the reason why. Just as the old generation perished in the wilderness on account of sin, so that even the great Moses, the holy Moses, the most humble, the greatest prophet who ever lived, even he can't cross the Jordan if that doesn't set a sign on account of his sin. And I do not rate his sin, you shouldn't do so either, but that's the reason. He can't cross the Jordan. And as Israel now stands at Moab, faced with a lifetime of decision in the land, the message is, well, what is it? What's the message of this song that summarizes the covenant that we've been studying for months, more than a year now? The last two verses distill it, verses 46 and 47. It's a commentary on the song. Take to heart all the words by which I am warning you today, that you may command them to your children, that they may be careful to do all the words of this law. And here it comes. For this is no empty word for you, but your very life. Well, what would it look like then? Taking to heart the words of this covenant and to be careful to do them, and yes, also to teach them to your children. What would this look like? Does it mean not to steal? Does it mean not to murder? Does it mean not to commit adultery? Does it mean not to worship foreign gods? Yes, all of these are included. But ultimately, taking the words to heart is to live daily by trusting in God's grace. You see, Israel will sin. Israel will fail. Israel will break covenant. Israel will forget. But she can retain, she is supposed to retain, the hope of God's intervention in the future. And so the song teaches. That's what the song teaches. It walks the grade between the people's uselessness, their corruption, and God's intervention, despite their corruption. It's on account of this promised grace. After all the blessings of God have already been forfeited and the people are off the stage, they've been ushered off the stage, they're in exile. It's on account of the promised grace after the judgment that Israel will never have the right to sink into despair. They have no right to sink into despair because God places them in a story leading from blessing to curse to restoration. And if God is taken at this word, the happy end for Israel is always looming. And it's integral to the story. And so hope exists. But only by trusting in this grace of God. Because the history, the chart, has already been mapped. We know that the map was correct. We know that the words were true. It happened just as Moses predicted. It's essentially a life of faith, isn't it? It's essentially a walk of faith. To live by this, to trust God for the grace that He has promised, it's essentially a walk of faith, the same way that we are to walk before God. It's also the assurance that God's grace will outlive the sins of the people. His grace will outlive the sins of the people. This is His glory. He does not change. His steadfast love endures. Now we can, by way of extrapolation, see the architecture of blessing, judgment, and restoration in this song as the blueprint of Christ's mission. The mystery of faith that unfolded in His life and then between a Friday and a Sunday. The cross on Friday is a day of darkness, gloom, and termination. After a period of blessing, a period of hearing the voice of the gracious bridegroom at a wedding of God's own making. Something that in this form had never happened before and in one way or another will never happen again. But on Friday, on that Friday, sin is gathered into a small space, into the body of Jesus Christ, and put to the sword of God's judgment. But the judgment gives way to a Sunday morning and all the indisputable facts of doom that the cross proclaims to all the world are exploded in a new manifestation of God acting, God's mercy. To live by this story is life. And what is that but to live by the grace of God? I don't know no other. I don't know a better term for it. To live by this story is to live by grace, is to live by grace. Grace of God, whose final intervention will also make perfect what's still lacking in us here and now. And early Christians, like Moses, they also wrote songs. Songs of these simple contours of the story, of the gospel story. They wrote songs. Some of them are even preserved in the New Testament. But you see that God is the key defining player in the song and in the gospel. Moses' songs bear witness to God's sovereign capacity for both judgment and mercy. Mercy at a point when all seems lost. Judgment is a divine necessity. Mercy is God's free act. Judgment is God's prerogative, and in one way, you'd have to say He has no choice with a judgment. Eventually, there must be a judgment. This is His world. Judgment is His prerogative. Mercy, however, is what He delights in. This song, however, not only teaches the possibility of God acting in mercy, it declares that He will. He will. And this is the reason why the song and the entire book of Deuteronomy at heart deliver a positive, optimistic message in the context of utter human failure. To me, that sounds very much like the gospel. And did you notice the song's opening words? Says Moses, "Yeah, give ear, O heavens, and I will speak, and let the earth hear the words of my mouth. May my teaching drop as the rain, my speech distill as the dew, like gentle rain on the tender grass, and like showers on the earth. For I will proclaim the name of the Lord, ascribe greatness to our God." Verses 1 through 3. The images of rain and of dew are images of life. The rain falls on the earth drinks the rain, produces fruit. The dew refreshes a thirsty landscape. These are images of life. And it ends, this poem, this song ends with Moses declaring his word to be Israel's very life. Verse 47. The frame around the poem is life. That's because, as Moses says in verse 3, he's proclaiming the name of the Lord. He ascribes greatness to our God. And for you, for those who rely on his name, even words of judgment are words of life, because with God there is a story, a future, and judgment isn't his final word. He brings judgment, but he also restores his people. And it's only when we do what Moses says, take to heart his words, that is, what God says of human nature and the resulting judgment, and what he says about his free mercy, that the words become life for you. It isn't that they aren't life in and of themselves, but for you, the words will not be applied. They will not become life unless you believe them, unless you take them to heart. That's what I believe it means, to take these words to heart. It's to take them in simple faith. And so you see the two notions of a corrupt human nature and the judgment and God's free mercy intersect in verse 36. At the lowest point of the story, the lowest point of the song, this is how it reads. For the Lord will vindicate his people. Well, if you only stop there, that comes out of nowhere. If you read the preceding verses, this comes out of thin air. There is nothing that should indicate that God will vindicate his people, but he will. The Lord will vindicate his people and have compassion on his servants. There is nothing in the text that even remotely suggests that this compassion is triggered by anything but God's free choice. God will have compassion, however, on his mercy, on his servants. And this is the context in which he will show his mercy, when he sees that their power is gone. Now, how many times have I told you, in the context of preaching from the book of Deuteronomy, that God goes to work when he brings you to your end? He brings you to the end of yourself. This is what God says here. I will bring you to the end of yourself. When he sees that their power is gone and there is nothing remaining, none, bond or free. The name of the Lord is the guarantee of life, just as the words of this covenant are life. When Israel trusts God's grace, a grace that is now more fully revealed in his Son, Jesus Christ. How does the Apostle Paul put it? He says, while we were still sinners, that is to say, in the context of this song, at our lowest point, at our very worst, while we were still sinners, Christ died for us and opened the door to a new life and the hope of the gospel. Are you in this story of divine grace? And we often wonder why the Christian life could be so difficult. And we wonder why we have so little joy in it. So much of it seems to be such a struggle. And then we resort to praying more, praying harder, more frequently, reading the Bible more, and bring to bear the whole range of Christian disciplines in pursuit of the fuller Christian experience that Joel Osteen urges you to have. And we still come up short. What are we doing wrong? We're prone to pursue good things. All people are. You choose what is good for you, but you pursue what is good for you. That's what you think you should be doing. Everyone does it. We are prone to pursue good things, blessings of God, even the blessings of the covenant of life, but fail to see that chasing the gifts for the gift's sake will not deliver the goods. In fact, it's a subtle form of legalism. And many Christians are also guilty of a subtle form of legalism that, in the worst case scenario, ends in a self-righteousness that cannot be assailed by anyone or anything anymore. And in some better cases, though also sad enough, it leads to despondency and hopelessness and this syndrome that we call burnout. But it's a subtle form of legalism to pursue gifts for the sake of the gifts, of the payoff. The gifts that Israel had in the land, they were good, and they pursued them as well as they should have pursued them. But they failed to pursue the giver. In the same way, we Christians can engage in Christian exercises because we know that this is what we should be doing, and we know that in a mechanical sort of way, this is what brings this fuller life experience home to us. But we never get to the bottom of the problem. We need to pursue God. Praying and reading God's word, worship and fellowship, all these are wonderful gifts. They are gifts. But even they are useless unless in the service of the pursuit of God himself. You see, and you can ask yourself whether you really seek him when you open your Bible or when you sit down to pray or when you come to worship. Or whether you're only going through the motions to fill your daily quota of Christian performances. And believe you me, there is one who can tell the difference. This is why we need a story. This is why we need a song like this that tells a story. We need to place ourselves in a story that has God as the main character, the sovereign of justice and mercy. And what Israel heard in this song makes God exceedingly great, as verse 3 says, ascribes greatness to God. It makes God exceedingly great, so great that everything else is eclipsed by his glorious presence. Presence that fills everything and changes everything. Even the worst of things can appear in a new light. This week I read about a man named Johann Heinrich Wichern. Can you say Johann Heinrich Wichern? I know that you will have trouble with the sh sound. I'm not used to it myself anymore, but it's very common in German. Johann Heinrich Wichern was the founder of the 19th century home missions in Hamburg, Germany. That's where I was born. He lived in the 19th century. Now, before the gates of the old Hanseatic city, Hamburg, he established what was called the Rough House. It was a shelter for washed up youths. One day they brought him a boy with the most distraught and defiant look on his face. Vision read the shocking report of the Department of Youth in the flickering light of the candle. As I said, it was the 19th century. And then he said to the boy, "Well, now I know much about your story. But in this place, you can begin anew. Jesus also died for your sins. And Jesus was also raised for your justification." And then he took the document from the Department of Youth, an official document, and he burned it in the candle. You're not defined by your past sins. You're not defined by the failures of the past. From now on, a new story has begun for you. If you believe, you are now in God's story. And with his grace, everything becomes new. And just as the candle burns the report of the boy, the rising hope of this song shatters the people's sins. And just as the candle burns the report, our guilt is incinerated by the love of Jesus Christ, who gave himself up for us. This is the message. In essence, this is the message of the song of Moses, which renders you unimpeachable, unimpeachable. Even though we don't seem to fit in, no, we don't. We don't seem to fit in with God, with our past and our present life. And it's appropriate then to close with a line from the mouth of Job, who knew a thing or two about facing impossible odds, thing or two about hardship. "Thanks be to God who gives songs in the night." Job 35:10. Our gospel is the true song in the night, proclaiming the dawn of the coming day. Learn the song, learn it well, learn to sing it, learn it for yourself and others also. Live by trusting in the grace of God. That's what it's all about. Amen.